there is nothing that changes things like love. So for me, that, you know, in some ways, perhaps people would say, oh, it's a bit of a bumper sticker, God is love. But at depth, this is about how it is that we human beings are able to move beyond ourselves and yet take that interior journey into ourselves at the same time and understand that that is held and loved, and from that learn to love ourselves. And it might be that the world would have more hope, more grace, more peace if we're all able to do that in a way that was a bit undefended, if you like, where we could allow those things that we have to put up as defences to be freely and trustingly open. Now, it's a really tough ask.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This series delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we will meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them, women who are changing the world from right here in WA. The Right Reverend Kay Goldsworthy was ordained as an Archbishop in 2018, the only woman in the world to hold this position in the Anglican Church. She believes that spiritual growth is an important part of human development and one that all people have the right to experience. She's a human rights advocate, a pastoral care worker, and an amazing listener. This is Season 3, Episode 10 of Her Story with the Right Reverend Kay Goldsworthy. This is Her Story. Kay, thank you so much for joining us on Her Story. I was particularly interested in speaking to you because when I've spoken to other women for this podcast, many of them have cited their faith as something that has kept them moving towards their goal or working towards what it is they've dedicated their lives to. You're someone who has made your faith your whole job. What was it that made you go, it's not just that I want my faith to be a part of my life driving me towards something, but I want my faith to be the centre?
Yeah, great question. I don't know that I thought of it quite that way, because from an early age, faith was centre.
Mm.
So that was always the centre point from which I might do something else. And one of the things that it occurred to me early on, very early on, was that it might be that I could live faith by working in it. And so from my story, that would be about having grown up in a household where faith was active. You know, we spoke about God, we believed in God, we did it differently. You know, religion was essentially my mother's business, and making sure we did the right thing about going to church was my father's role. But I had experienced women who were, you know, in inverted commas, in ministry in the life of my church, deaconesses, which was a particular order of ministry for lay women. So I thought it's possible for women to do this.
Mm.
And so when I was 16, I first made an inquiry about that, whether it might be possible for me. And they, of course, said, oh, that's lovely. Now go away, and when you grow up a bit, come back when you've been to university and talk to us again.
And that was for the role of deaconess?
That was.
Mm. What does that role entail that makes it a lay position rather than a ordained position?
Effectively, it was about an authorised, if you like, an authorised ministry for women. So women could not be deacons, priests, or bishops, the three orders of ministry for Anglicans. But deaconesses was an authorised ministry and called a lay ministry.
Oh, it was like the consolation prize for the girlies.
Yeah, some people may have seen it that way. And certainly as time went by and as I was growing into a deepening understanding of what it is I might be and do, deaconess, I don't want to say consolation because some of those women were astounding and did absolutely fantastic things. But it would be clear to say that many people would read the New Testament talking about deaconess and think what they're talking about is a female deacon, not something other, which you simply could only be a group of women.
Mm. When we look at the idea of there being these particular ordained roles within the Anglican Church, those roles have always been filled by men. How long has it been that they have been able to be filled by women?
Mm-hmm. So if I say a little bit about my story, if that works. So I started training, as it were, in 1981. I was 23. And in 1984, I did become a deaconess because women could not be deacons. And in 1986, the first group of women were able to be ordained deacons in Australia, and that was in Melbourne. And I happened to be in that group. So that had been going through our synods, essentially a sort of church governance and parliamentary gathering, making decisions, passing laws for the church in order for new things to happen. And then I moved to Perth in 1988, and in 1992, the first group of women were ordained as priests, and so happened that that happened here in Perth. So first group of women ordained as deacons, 86, the first group of women ordained as priests, 1992, and that was a big year. In 1992, women were able to be ordained in many parts of Australia, and the cry amongst Anglican women these days, and men, is 92 in 92, because there were 92 women ordained that year. And then it was some years later before women were able to be ordained as bishops, or consecrated, if you want to use that language, as bishops, and that was in 2008. And again that happened in Perth, and again I happened to be the first person who became a bishop. So it's been a long process.
It's been a 2,000-year process.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. For us, although interestingly, the first woman ever ordained a priest in the Anglican Communion, so around the world, is a woman called Florence Lee Tim Oi, and she was ordained in Hong Kong during the Second World War, when the bishop at the time, there was nobody else. So she was ordained and she offered ministry in and across borders into Chinese territories on the border in Hong Kong and into areas, and there were no men. After the war, she stopped acting as a priest and didn't act again. I can't quite remember when it was, but it was many, many years later in Canada that she began to operate as a priest again. So it's an interesting thing that of necessity a woman was allowed to be a priest, but she stood back. Actually, a lot of women would say that's a Second World War story, stood back, and it was many years later. In Australia, the first discussion in our church, or the first commission report about whether women should be ordained or be allowed to be ordained alongside men, was in 1968. And that report said there was no theological reason that it couldn't happen. But then, of course, the debates began to grow. And by the time I had offered for ministry, not thinking ever that I would be a priest, I wouldn't have dared use the language. By the time that happened, we were quite fiery about it all.
I was just going to say, did you get angry?
Certainly there were times when I'd feel angry or feel bewildered or feel frustrated or simply feel the weight of what was certainly some prejudice and I thought inadequate theological understanding.
that's where you understood the argument for the other side, that they had an inadequate understanding of what was being said. When you first approached your church as a 16-year-old and said that you were interested in becoming a deaconess, and they said, go on, go to uni, did you end up going to uni?
No, as it turned out. not then.
You were like, no, I'm not going to do anything you tell me to now.
Yeah, probably. There was a bit of that in me. No, it wasn't quite like that. In fact, I went to Deaconess House, so I went to speak to the deaconesses at the time. And you know, sitting now as a woman in her 60s, it was absolutely clear to me that they were quite right. I was very young. I wouldn't have been ready. So when they said, look, I think essentially they were saying, go and study some more, and that would give you a sense of their expectation. And then maybe study some more, do a first degree, and then study some theology. We'll work with you then. Oh, I didn't do that. I went and did other things. I went, worked in a restaurant, ran a restaurant for a few years, and one day sat up, you know, 5 or 6 years later and went, I could be good at this. In fact, I could be really good at this. This could be my career, but it doesn't feel like the right thing.
Mm.
So I had a real sense of vocation and a deep sense of, I could do any number of things. I could do restauranting and that would be delightful.
Of course, and there's so many similarities in both symbolically and sharing a meal, but also in the idea that to work in hospitality, you are hospitable. You welcome people.
And serve. So in hospitality, I mean, it's absolutely essential theological understanding about the nature of God, you know. That God is loving and hospitable to us human beings and in creation. And so, yes, that all sits, doesn't it, very well. And that notion of service also, of caring for people and helping people to find a space, which we do around the table, find a space in which we can have deep conversation, meet each other, and new things come to light.
What was it that you think you needed to learn, that you think you personally needed to grow into, to be able to be effective as a leader in the church?
Oh, there'd be a lot of people who say I still have a lot to learn as to me in order to be effective. Not so long ago, I was in another part of the country and preaching, and I talked about that I want to be somebody who speaks of grace. And I do think that has been a significant part of how I understand God, how I want to live faith, and that a starting point for me is hospitality and welcome and a love which is so very deep that it is transformative and that it can hold us in every circumstance. And I would talk about God's mercy as God's love, because there is nothing that changes things like love. So for me, that, you know, in some ways perhaps people would say, oh, it's a bit of a bumper sticker, God is love. But at depth, this is about how it is that we human beings are able to move beyond ourselves and yet take that interior journey into ourselves at the same time and understand that is held and loved, and from that learn to love ourselves. And it might be that the world would have more hope, more grace, more peace if we're all able to do that in a way that was a bit undefended, if you like, where we could allow those things that we have to put up as defences to be freely and trustingly open. Now, it's a really tough ask.
We talk about this idea of grace and offering grace to people. When we think about the synods and the way that decisions are made within the Anglican Church. We acknowledge the decision that has been made around ordaining women, and now decisions are being made around LGBTQI plus communities, both in terms of being ordained. How are you leading this conversation in a way that is showing grace?
So this is a big question, and this is not only an Anglican church in Perth or in Australia, this is an Anglican church around the world conversation that's taking place and has been taking place for quite a number of years. And last year at the Lambeth Conference, so this is a conference which usually happens once every 10 years, where the Archbishop of Canterbury, who we call the sort of first among equals, invites bishops from around the world to come together for some period of time of conference and learning and being alongside. So it was meant to happen 2018, it didn't. COVID happened, so it was 2022 when we met. And he said, I mean, there were a number of people who didn't come from countries in the world where they believe that the church has got it wrong about understanding around same-sex relationships, the place of same-sex attracted people in ministry, the way that the church can order marriages, blessings, all those things. Some churches didn't come, mostly churches from the global south and some people with more conservative views. And he said at one point, in many ways, this has been based in the way that people say we read scripture, the way that we understand scripture, and that scripture is very clear. The Archbishop said in this meeting, everybody takes the Bible really seriously, and people come to different conclusions. And in the taking seriously, also take seriously where they live, the culture in which they live, the society in which they live, the church in which they live, and they respond to that. And I thought that was a really useful thing for him to have said in that gathering at that time. So in Australia, we have been, since marriage equality, 2017, before that, but really since then, very, very focused on, is it possible for the blessing of same-sex relationships, marriages, a big part of civil marriages, is it possible for that to take place inside churches? There have been a legal case, an appellate tribunal case for us, and the appellate tribunal ruled that it was possible for Anglicans to bless civil marriages, essentially same-sex marriages. But our primate, so again, the bishop in Australia who's the sort of chairs our bishops' meetings and all of that, asked everybody to just hold while we all kind of dealt with what this was all about and all those things, and how we were going to deal with each other, because people are talking about broken fellowship and broken relationship and, you know, all of those things. I've said to people, can we just, you know, the primate's asked us if we'll act with some restraint for the moment, so if we could do that while we, these discussions, these conversations going on. And that's incredibly costly. It's very costly for those who want to be able to offer this ministry. The assumptions that we might be making about, you know, there's going to be a flood of people wanting to come to a church in order to have their marriage blessed, I think is an assumption. I think there are a lot of people who probably have an experience of the church as not having been welcoming to them, as same-sex attracted single people or people in relationships or people who are concerned about their brother, their father, their daughter, their cousin, their friend, whoever. And certainly there are people who will have had experiences of being asked to see themselves differently, and people will have been asked to do that.
It's a little bit like cool girl way of looking at it, isn't it? As the church going, as soon as we make this decision, all these people are going to be coming and wanting to be married. We're so popular, everyone's just going to be, like, everyone's just been waiting for us to say yes. Whereas everyone's actually just been off living their lives.
And, well, precisely.
And are now going, excuse me.
Yeah, and why would I go back to a place that I was not welcome?
Mm.
Why would we do that now? Of course, there are people of faith who would like to do that. There are many people of faith who would like to take that step or would like to have that offered to them. So we're in the middle of that discussion.
And so the discussion is not just about, are we getting people married in this church? Are we ordaining queer people in this church? The discussion is about how are we making this church actually welcoming to diverse groups of people, to everyone, and not just the people that look like us.
Yes. And I'm really aware that those people with a different view from me would say, but we are making the church welcome. And I would say, well, right, okay. And I hope that I'm part of encouraging people to say, there is a welcome here for you. So, in fact, we're not allowed to marry in our churches, but a civil marriage, a blessing, that's the conversation that's going on. And in the middle of that, there are people who are called to ministry who are same-sex attracted. That's no new thing, by the way.
Mm.
And particularly people who may have a domestic partnership that's been raising some issues for people, but not everyone. We need to really hold on, and there's been a lot of energy just recently because I've just ordained somebody who's in a partnership, and there was an objection made at that ordination, and a lot of people had added their names to that, and a lot of people inside a cathedral also stood up and said, we accept them gladly. So, you know, we're quite divided. And people are calling this an issue about, you know, one's salvation. Now, I don't see that. I don't understand that. I don't believe that's the right way of reading this in any way, shape or form. So we do ask people to live with a discipline. We do ask people to live with a moral and ethical discipline. And that makes sense. And that makes sense to me about a number of things, but this has become quite a sharp edge, and it's still quite current because it has only been a couple of weeks ago.
When do you get time to just be Kay?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because I've been at this for a long time now. And I've been in this particular role since 2018. And I was, you know, been a bishop for 15 years. I realise that every now and again, when one of our kids or another family member might sort of make a bit of fun of me, and I think, oh gosh, I just sounded like the bishop there. I do have a sense these days, I think, of a place. And I do hold a particular place. And so when do I get to be just me? Yeah, you know, I am pretty much what you see is what you get. I do think we've got to be authentically. It's a current word, I know. But there does need to be some authenticity between both what you say and what you do. You know, the big issue for people in the life of the church is that we say one thing and we do another.
Mm.
Or we get into church and we have a voice that nobody would ever recognise, or we are, you know, completely divorced from reality. And I don't think that that's who I am. So I think I'm fairly down to earth and fairly feet on the ground. And there are some costs associated with this role and this vocation, and that's just how it goes. Yeah, so around the house, I think, and you know, what do I like to do? I love to cook. Cooking's really good for me. It's quite therapeutic. The lovely thing with cooking is that you take a few ingredients and you add them together and you produce something, and then you can enjoy it as long as it's worked out.
do you have a favourite recipe?
Oh, I have many. As long as, you know, quite different from human beings, because, you know, human beings, we're complex and we think, oh, that's going in one direction and suddenly it's going in a different direction, or it's not quite as straightforward as you thought it might be.
Kay, I'm quite sure that this has been a sermon at some point. Have you used this in an analogy in a sermon?
Possibly. And why not?
RTR is, of course, a place where we are a little bit obsessed with music. And when we talk about church, we're, you know, a lot of people's memories involve singing and music. And sometimes those memories are very bad. Very bad music and very bad singing. And sometimes those memories are very good. I still know the song Jesus Loves the Little Children.
Oh, all the children of the world.
All the children of the world.
Then there are various colours.
I'm not going to say the next line because it's terrible. But I often find that the songs that touch me the most in my life are those that are not intended to be sung in church. Do you have your own favourite music or your favourite musician that whenever you listen to them you think, oh, they know what it is to be human. They know what it is to reach for something higher than themselves.
Yes, I listen to a lot of classical music these days. So letting music wash over is therapeutic for me and useful for me. And beautiful, beautiful notes. I love Taverner. I love the way Taverner just brings a note and brings a note and takes another note, which means I also like some 16th century music as well, because that sort of has that same feel to it. And, you know, Paul Kelly, here we are. We're currently moving towards Christmas. So
it's definitely Paul Kelly season.
We'll all be making gravy soon. So, you know, there are things like that. But these days I think it's really interesting, isn't it? I think I'm doing classical more and more these days.
It's almost like the words are inadequate to express what it is that you're feeling.
Yeah. Well, there's a note that is pure and lovely. I'm off thinking about the music that gets played in our household because, you know, my husband listens to a lot of music that's blues and rock and, you know, those things. So all of that, and I'm a person of a generation, so of course it's a different generation from what is current.
So your husband's got the Rolling Stones cranking?
Yes, he does. Or yes, exactly. You know, always, and watching a documentary about, you know, them then. You know, it's all that stuff.
He's got Mick Jagger being all like sexy into the microphone, and you're like, please, darling, I'm trying to write a sermon.
I'm in another room.
I am interested in what it's like to have something be both your job, in that there is a business component to what you do. There is a business administrative management component to being the Archbishop. You're in charge of people. And yet also you are leading people's spiritual growth. You have a flock. How do these two things meet? How do you make sure that you are being responsible for the church as an institution, but also considerate of the church as a people?
Yeah. Sometimes they clash, and it's not easy to hold those things together. The institutional bit is it's being reformed whether we want it to be reformed or not, and certainly there are bits of it that have needed big reform, and that's a reality. It is shifting and moving, and I think that the 21st century has rushed at a church like ours at a great rate. And there are things at its heart which need to be held. So discerning and deciding about what needs to be held and honoured and is really, really important. And what's a little more, you know, the adiaphora, can just be sort of left to its own devices, is different. Clergy are not employees, they're office bearer's office. And so they, you know, entrusting and trusting them for maturity and disciplined action and life and care and leadership is not so straightforward, and sometimes it's just a joy. So it's a mixed bag, but working our way through this part of the 21st century is really, really has many challenges, but a lot that is just fantastic about it. And I think that it is really important to hold on to the fact, for me to hold on to the fact, that when there are issues, you know, you're just dealing with stuff because you've got work, you've got, as you say, office, organisation, institution, and then there are people, that holding those two alongside and within that, the very essence of what it is that this community, this organisation, this body, you know, to use that language, stands for and represents, and where its life comes from, is to reach into something which is deeper than those things for which we have words, and more than the hopes than people can express. And I, you know, bone deep believe that our spirituality is absolutely important and essential to us as human beings. And how does that live for good and for grace and show forth the love which can encourage a tired world? I think, you know, it's another sermon I'm giving you now. But that's really, really important.
Kay, it's been so nice speaking to you. I'm so glad that you were able to come in and talk to us about your life as the only female archbishop in Australia. I was wondering, do you think that Henry VIII had any idea what he was creating when he started the Anglican Church? Do you think he would have seen the world that we live in today?
Not the first clue. And I think that not the first clue. And I think that the affairs of state were very important at the time.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks to the Right Reverend Kay Goldsworthy and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make her story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reed is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Wadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name is Beck Bowman. Join us next week when we meet Senator Dorinda Cox.